91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program begins with arguments. No, never Bonnie and I, but with couples counselor and psychologist Dr. Michelle Brody. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Dr. Brody has a plan to reduce or end those fateful swirls of brewing argument. Most are caused by recurrent issues, of course. Her book is Stop the Fight, The 12 Most Common Arguments. And more on the menu, chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer has more from this week's huge South Beach Food and Wine Festival. We'll visit with one of the Food Network star personalities, Chef Jeffrey Zakarian, one of the judges on the network's Chopped program. Stay with us. Topical Currents up next after news. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper and my co-host, Bonnie Berman, who I never argue with. Argue with her.
That's a good idea.
I could learn a few things from her about it.
Oh, come on.
Well, no matter how rich or poor, these are the results from a study. Couples who argue about money early in the relationship are more likely to divorce.
And a surprising one, couples who share housework are more likely to split up, at least in Norway, where the study was conducted.
Well, whatever, but there hasn't been a divorce that didn't begin with arguments.
And usually the same ones crop up over and over again. With us now is couples therapist and clinical psychologist, Dr. Michelle Brody.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks. Good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Her new book is Stop the Fight, an illustrated guide for couples, how to break free from the 12 most common arguments. And she joins us from sunny White Plains, New York.
Not
is it sunny?
Sunny, unfortunately.
Okay. Yeah, maybe not.
Well, not a beach day there?
No, I wish I was near you.
Well, we have a little chill in the air today. So, Dr. Brody, why are illustrations and diagrams more effective in breaking these cycles of repetitive arguments more effective than just words?
So one of the things that makes a picture worth more, especially when it comes to couples fights, is that when we're involved in a fight, we really can only see our own side. And that sets us up for continuing the fight. When you see the whole big picture of the fight, and what I do with my clients is actually draw out the what's happening in a diagram, you can see both sides and you can understand why you're triggering each other. So when you can see the whole thing, suddenly there are new options for dealing with it as opposed to just looking at it from the point of view of what's my pain, what's bothering me in this fight, which tends to bring about more fighting behavior as opposed to more solution behavior.
So you address the universal need of those involved in an argument, the need to prove the point.
Yeah.
That's the point of escalation.
Right. If you think about it, when you feel pain with someone else, whether it's a loved one, a coworker, or your partner, when you feel pain, your instinct, you know, your fight-or-flight mechanism jumps into play, and your instinct is to defend yourself. Part of defending yourself is proving that you're right. Right? So in a fight, I'm going to spend my time trying to show you that I'm right, and of course, naturally, that means proving that you're wrong, but as soon as I do that, none of us like to be told we're wrong, so the partner or the other person in the fight is going to fight right back, and that's, you got two people trying to prove their point, and that gets quite escalated over time. If you're not convincing each other, and it certainly doesn't feel good for either party, and neither one is getting their pain dealt with, they're just generating more.
Are these methods effective, your methods, for only romantic couples, or can they be used for mothers, daughters, brothers, sisters, whatever?
They can be used for every kind of fight. In fact, I actually also work as an executive coach in corporate environments, helping companies, teams, partners, business partners, get out of conflict with each other. And it's pretty universal for all those fights, including, you know, mothers and daughters and any other combination you can imagine, because we all do the same thing in fights. We all get defensive in fights, and defensiveness is what keeps the fight going. And when you can see that in any fight, you start to recognize there's a real pattern. You know, when I work with couples, sometimes people will say, that I'm working with will say, oh, this will work with my employees. And when I'm working with executives, sometimes they'll say, oh, I got to bring this home and talk to my wife about it. So it's just human nature that we're dealing with in fights.
So being an executive coach, that means you coach executives, not that
right.
You're a coach who's an executive.
No, okay. Right. No, I coach executives who want some help with some of the people issues that are interfering with their business.
I'm just a little surprised about the seeing being more effective than hearing, because when it comes to communicating ideas, I would have thought that would depend more on how an individual processes information. Like, some people do need to see things. Other people just need to hear things, you know? But you're saying universally that a picture is worth a thousand words.
Well, the reason is, it's a really good point, because you're right. So people process things differently. But what I'm trying to get around in showing people a picture of a fight is that it's very hard to hold two kinds of information at the same time. And with hearing, you're limited by time to whatever you're hearing right now, right? So in a picture, you can actually see two ideas happening at the same time. And that's why I think it's somewhat more effective, because what you've really got to see is what's happening on the other side of the fight. What am I, and it's not just what's happening, what is my partner experiencing on a deeper level that causes them to act in that really annoying way in which they act, right? And it's very hard to see that while you're simultaneously feeling your own pain and trying really hard to be heard.
Right.
So that's what makes it just trickier, and usually our eyes can bring in a little more of that information so that the multiple perspectives, you can kind of hold it better. And I discovered that just by working with couples, and noticing that when I would talk about what was happening, I'd say, let me tell you what I hear is happening. You know, you're feeling this and you're feeling that. At every moment that I would be empathizing with one party, the other party would be sitting kind of on their hands saying, but what about my side? But if I show a picture of both sides simultaneously, everyone can kind of feel like their perspective is represented.
Right.
Is the basic root of most of these fights really just insecurity in the relationship? You may fight about money, but actually it's a deeper insecurity?
Yeah, I think it's true that the question that comes up for us with any fight about any topic is, do you care about me? Are you there for me? So if I'm worried about money, if I'm feeling insecure about our finances right now, and I tell you that, and I beg you to not spend more money because that makes me feel more insecure, if you go out and you buy yourself a really nice new piece of clothing, I'm going to walk away feeling like you don't care about me, because I just told you about my fear and you didn't respond to it. So I think, yes, I completely agree. Fundamentally, what's beneath it is, do you care about me? Are you there for me? Will you respond to me if I put out a real hurt? Will you really see that I'm asking for something from you and be there for me? And so one of the fights that I talk about in the book is the you don't care about me fight, which in many ways underlies a lot of fights about other things, like fights about money or fights about sex or fights about household chores. If you're not helping me with the chores, if you're not helping me with sex, if you're not hearing me out about money, do you care about me? That's kind of what's under it.
I would think that sex, though, that fight would be a little more fragile than you're not helping me out with the housework.
In what respect?
Well, because people can take that so personally versus they're not doing something, you know, like housework versus I just think it's a more delicate area, isn't it?
I think it's true. There's the hurt is a little bit different, you know,
right.
For the person who's saying, please help me with the housework and not getting responded to, they feel overburdened and feel ignored or unhelped. But for someone who's reaching out and saying, please have sex with me, and the other person is resisting that, they not only feel unheard, they also feel rejected on a very fundamental level.
Exactly.
Of like, am I desirable? Am I appealing to you?
Am I lovable?
You know, am I lovable? It is very fundamental. It's true.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with a comment or question for Dr. Michelle Brody, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or you can give us a quick one, email radio@WLRN.org.
So, Dr. Brody, let's just talk about the basics, because most couples fight in some form or fashion, but not all of these fights are created equal. So when it's repetitive and involves into this frustrating pattern with no cure in sight, that maybe is, what's a good fight look like, and what's a bad or destructive fight? What does that look like?
Well, so I think about it not so much as what's happening during the fight that makes it destructive or less so. I mean, certainly some fights during the fight are much more destructive than others. When
right.
you get to name calling and
right.
you get to, you know, throwing things, you know, obviously much more destructive. But the real key, I think, for couples is if you can repair after a fight, then it can be very constructive. The real devastating fights are the ones that just have no resolution. And so either both parties walk, like, storm out of the room, or they walk away with simmering resentment. There's no end to it. And that just leaves you still in the pain you started with. So a good fight is one where you could actually come down from being in a defensive place and return to speaking of the softer feelings that were under the fight for you. So, for example, you know, a very simple fight that happens a lot now is one person is busy in their phone, and the partner is feeling really ignored and is reaching out and saying, hey, can we talk about something? And the partner says, let me just finish this bunch of emails that I've got going on. So what's happening in that fight? Now, that seems on the surface to be a very light fight, but it can go many, many rounds to the point where the person who's watching their partner in their phone is feeling terribly ignored. And, you know, they might fight very loudly about it, but ultimately underneath for that person is that they feel ignored. But they're reaching out, and they keep asking the partner, pay attention to me. Come on. I don't like what you're doing right now. So the second partner, the one who's on their phone at the moment, feels nagged and criticized.
Okay, so
right?
take that very case. You're working
okay.
with a couple, and okay. that's exactly what's gone on. What do you do?
Okay, so when they're in the angry part of the fight, they're using all kinds of arguments about why they're right, why it's improper to be on your phone when someone's reaching out for you, or why it's improper to be nagging someone. But what's underneath it, and if I can help a couple talk about, and couples can do this on their own, after the fight is over, ask each other, what was going on for you there? Or if you already know, you don't have to ask, you can say, I think I know what was happening there. I was feeling ignored, and I was reaching out for you, but when I reached out for you, you were feeling nagged. And I could understand why that would feel pretty bad, too. And then when you were feeling nagged, you were tuning me out. But when you tuned me out, I felt ignored. Look at this cycle we're stuck in. For many of us, the most important step is to actually see that it's a cycle. It's not one-sided. It's not like one person is just being annoying and the other person is totally innocent. It's the fact that because we're feeling hurt, we do defensive things that inadvertently hurt our partner and start this cycle. So if you can actually sit down together, see what the cycle is, recognize the hurt feelings on both sides, that's when the discussion really begins, and that's when solutions start. It's like, oh, you were feeling really ignored. I get that, but I was also feeling this. How do we manage those situations so that neither one of us comes out feeling ignored or nagged? Is there a way out of that?
So basically what you're talking about is better communication between people, communicating
right.
what you're feeling and being open to the other person communicating what they're feeling.
Right. So, and very specifically, what we mean by better communication is getting underneath to the softer feelings, the ones that are really about, I care about you and I need you and I want to connect with you and I'm having trouble doing that right now. That's what the core of good communication ends up being, not masterfully figuring out how to craft a sentence in order
right,
to get
right.
your point across, right?
Right. We're speaking with Dr. Michelle Brody. She's written Stop the Fight, an illustrated guide for couples, how to break free from the 12 most common arguments and build a relationship that lasts. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It's Thursday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Michelle Brody. She's joining us about her book, Stop the Fight, an illustrated guide for couples, how to break free from the 12 most common arguments.
Dr. Brody, just one more question. We're going to take our calls, but how does one know when they can solve their own issues and when they need professional help?
It's a really valuable question because that's something that people do wonder about a lot. I think when a fight gets really entrenched and every time you attempt to solve it, you can't make any headway on it, it starts to suggest that you need, a new look at it. Now, a lot of people will say, but we're not that bad. Why would I go to a therapist when we're not that bad off? I often have couples who come and just meet with me for one session just to kind of get under a knotty fight and get it, get it opened up again. Because it's hard to move back into that more vulnerable place and talk about what's happening for you in that softer way when the fight is really entrenched. And sometimes people just need help with that.
Okay.
We have some callers. Let's begin with Horatio. Horatio's in Fort Lauderdale. Welcome.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi. My question, I'm asking advice. Since I've been married, I've always been concerned about our financial health. And I've expressed this to my wife on a number of occasions, just telling her what I'd want for us. And how we can get there. And, oftentimes it's just for us to tighten our belts for a moment and to get to where we want, and then we can move on comfortably. But every time I speak about it, it doesn't seem as if it's being received because there's never any change in, for example, the spending habits. Mm. And I'm now trying to find out what other approach I could take to try and get her to be pulling in my direction from a financial standpoint.
Dr. Brody?
Well, so, Horatio, you're raising a question that so many people have, and it really is incredibly frustrating when you feel like you have a clear message and your partner's not accepting it. But here's something that happens a lot with money fights. If you think about it, there's always two sides. One person is always wanting to be a bit more conservative, more careful with money, and the other person is saying some message like, hey, you got to live life. You can't be that conservative. So if you think about it, underneath those two positions, there are two important values, right? One is living life. That's important. Not, saving without, without being able to enjoy somewhat. But financial security is also extremely important. So to try to get underneath that fight, it's important to think about both sides of it. How do we get both? Now, what happens in a fight like this, I would ask you, how does your wife react? And this is the key. She's going to have some reaction to being told that we need to conserve or to being told you have to stop spending. And that's what I'd be most interested in is how does it feel to her to hear that?
She always agrees. It's just that the action that one would expect after an agreement doesn't happen.
Right.
Because of her inclination or tendency to discover new ways of spending and justifying those spending.
Right, so she agrees, but then there's some part of her that is still inclined to do something different, right?
Doctor, does it also come down to the fact that, especially for very long, you really can't change anyone, basically, at least not for long?
Well, I think there's...
If you like to blow money, you like to blow money.
Yeah, people certainly have habits, right, that they and the way in which they interact with money, but... If you overlay a relationship on top of that and you say, look, you have your habit, and I know you want to spend, and I know that's something that gives you joy, but it also causes me fear, and it causes me some pain. How do we manage to have you still get your chance to spend when you feel the impulse and feel happy about that, but also not ignite my fear? Those are two sides of the feelings that we have to try to plan for. And typically... the spender in a relationship often feels very controlled or criticized by the other person. It comes in either extreme forms or in more subtle forms. And the person who's the saver feels like they have no control because they keep asking and they're not getting any security. So it's important as a couple to really sit down and talk about that part. What does it feel like? Does your wife, Horatio, I asked you that question and wanted to take to her, how does she feel when you tell her that you want to save? If she agrees, what gets in the way? Why is it difficult? What's happening for her? The more you can understand what her side of it looks like, the more she'll be willing to understand what your side looks like.
And it, and Horatio, it also looks like what you're trying to say is you don't mind that she spends, but you want to wait till you're more secure financially now, and then yep. she can spend more in the future, as long as you don't mean in 50 years, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And maybe that's something that can get worked out.
Right.
Yep.
All right, Horatio. Okay. Well, we wish you the best.
And we'll move we'll move along to Sandra. Sandra, she's in Miami. Hi.
Good afternoon. I have a question as far as your therapy sessions. I would like to know if they are available via Skype nowadays. It's so hard for couples to even get together and be together in the same place.
Yeah.
So I wanted to know if there's a variety of options available for therapy with Dr. Brody.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, up until now, I haven't been doing any Skype sessions because one of the things that I find very important is sitting with a couple and seeing not just the words that they say to each other, but the way in which their energy goes between them. So that feels very important because a lot of the keys to resolving a fight are first visible in the way in which people move with each other, almost like a dance. And so for me, it feels much more helpful to sit with a couple in person. But I do know there are some therapists who have been conducting sessions by Skype. It's something that is happening more and more these days.
Thank you for answering my question. And then the next little question I had was, do you have recommendations as far as therapists here where we live in the state of Florida?
Oh, I would have to do some research on that.
Do you have a website, Dr. Brody?
I do. I'm at www.stopthefight.com. That's the website for the book, so stopthefight.com. Or you can reach me on my practice website, which is coachingforcouplesny.com.
Okay, so either way.
Okay, Sandra, way. Thanks.
Okay?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And we have an emailer. This is pretty much like Horatio's situation, a little different. Doesn't talk about money, but it says, Susan says, what about the whole issue of a person who admits they're wrong, but nothing ever changes?
Well, so that's interesting. What I'd be curious about, and I think, you know, as you can hear how I answer some of these questions, what is it that I don't know about the situation that would help unlock the fight, right? So in this case, somebody is admitting they're wrong, they want to do better at something, whatever the issue is, they sense that there's a way in which they'd like to behave better, but they're running into trouble. So what I'd be curious about is, why are they running into trouble? What's the difficulty? Because sometimes people, you know, think about it like when you go on a diet and it's like pure willpower, you say, I definitely want to, you know, eat less, but something gets in the way. So I'd be really interested in what's getting in the way. Why can a person admit that they have difficulty with something but then have trouble? What's on the other side of it? So that would be something to get curious about, what's happening for your partner.
Hmm. I would ask you also, Dr. Brody, when people say, oh, yes, you're right, it'll never happen again, what I've noticed is many people don't listen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't listen. And so they keep on doing it again, even though they know, they say they won't, or they know they're wrong. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I think sometimes what happens in couples is that we ask our partners to commit to something that they might not actually be prepared to commit to. So I'll give you an example. I worked with a couple once where the woman said, I want you never to lie to me. Okay? I want you never to lie to me. And he said, sure, I'll never lie to you. But there were things that if he would say the truth about, she would feel terribly hurt. So his instinct was to not quite tell her the whole truth because he didn't want to hurt her.
Right.
So on the surface, she would say, commit to never lying. And he would say, absolutely, I'll never lie. But that didn't quite cover all the situations where, out of a really good place, like he didn't want to hurt her, you know, she would ask him, you know, you ever think about other women? And he'd think about it, and he'd say, no.
Or does this dress make me look fat?
Exactly, right? And so if you're asking for something that sounds easy to commit to on the surface, but actually isn't easy to commit to deep down, it doesn't really make sense to make a contract about it, because then the person really won't be able to keep to it. The question is, like, what is the real concern? If I say to you, don't ever lie to me, I don't really just need a commitment from you that you promise never to do that, but what I really want you to be able to say is, I'm going to really try, because that's important to you. But in those times when I'm going to have trouble doing that for another reason, how do I deal with that situation? When I feel the instinct to hide from you because I don't want to hurt you, and then you're going to call that a lie, how do we deal with that? So right. It's getting into the complexity of it, because just agreeing is it may not capture the whole thing.
Or they just want to just say, oh, of course,
right.
You know, you're right,
right.
You're right. Yeah. Well, I wish we had longer. Dr. Michelle Brody, clinical psychologist and executive coach, over 20 years of experience as a practicing therapist and specialist in resolving relational conflicts. And she is the founder of CoachingForCouplesNY.com. Stop the Fight, an illustrated guide for couples, how to break free from the 12 most common arguments and build a relationship that lasts. Thank you so much, Dr. Brody.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure.
Food and Dining, up next.
And welcome back to Thursday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman.
It's Food and Dining Thursday. You can't argue with that.
No, it's the official start of the 16th annual Food Network South Beach Food and Wine Festival. 15th, is it? Okay. It's one of the preeminent such events in the nation. It's raised around $8 million for the FIU School of Hospitality and Tourism. It also gives FIU students hands-on experience with industry leaders. With us now, chef, author, syndicated columnist, and our friend, Linda Gassenheimer.
So nice to be with you, Bonnie and Joe. Yeah, no, it's a big foodie weekend. The beach is going to be just packed. And as you mentioned, it's the 15th year. But you know what? Italian food is going to be front and center at several events. And our guest today is going to be there cooking up a storm at a lot of these events. He's Michael Pirollo. He's the chef owner with Janczewski of the very popular Macchialina, a restaurant. It's on Miami Beach. And now they have the new Bozzi, also on Miami Beach. Let's welcome Chef Michael Pirollo.
Hey, guys. Pleasure to be here with you guys today.
Well, thank you. I know you've got a busy time ahead of you. And we'd love to also hear from you, our listeners. Do you have questions or maybe comments about Italian foods, or maybe a comment about the South Beach Wine and Food Festival? Give us a call, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Or radio at WLRN.org.
And, of course, with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. Now, Fred gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column that you can read, and it was in this week's Miami Herald, or you can read it online. And also, Fred's column is on Saturday in the Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
I'm going to give some tips on how to go to the big walk-around tastings at the festival without hurting yourself.
What does that mean?
Yeah, I'm afraid to ask what that means.
You'll see.
Michael,
very important.
Okay. Michael Pirollo, I heard you make a little comment about that not hurting yourself business.
No, I think that if you've been to those tents, you understand that it's very easy to hurt yourself. So I'm excited about this tutorial.
Sounds good. Okay, well, first of all, thank you for joining us. I know you have an event tonight, and you must be very, very busy. It's called Italian Bites on the Beach. So tell us about this event. What is it about?
This is an awesome event. So it's hosted by Barilla Pasta, and it's great. It's I think it's around 30 to 40 chefs. We all have a table on the beach, and we're all presenting small bites. So this is actually my second year in a row doing this event. I even did it in New York this year, so it's one of my favorites for sure.
So what are you making?
We are doing rigatoni alla macchialina. So it's rigatoni tossed with braised baby pigs and tomato sauce. And then
braised
we make
baby pigs?
Yeah.
Okay.
How much do they weigh?
The baby pigs?
Yeah.
It's not anywhere. In the pasta.
I know that, but...
A still, whole pig in the pasta?
Yeah, the image of baby pigs.
No, yeah. It's very it's nice.
I should have said suckling pig. That's better.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's too bad we can't edit that out. But so suckling pigs, and then we shred the meat and toss it back with the tomatoes, the rigatoni, and then we put baby meatballs on top as well.
Oh wow, sounds delicious. You know, I think that a lot of us here don't realize. I know in Italy, suckling pig is just a wonderful addition to so many dishes. Dishes there in Italy, so it's a very Italian dish. So now, let me ask you, I ask a lot of the chefs, because how many people are you cooking for?
This is 2,000 people. Mm.
So you're making enough
and
food.
He's doing a radio interview.
Well, yeah, and he's here, 2,000 people. Where do you do all this? How do you get the food from wherever you're doing it to the beach?
They've got it so streamlined now, it's amazing. You go to the convention center, you drop it off, they put it in refrigerated trucks. And then today I'll show up on the beach, and it'll be at my booth in a refrigerated compartment.
And then you have to cook there on the beach?
Then that's the hard part.
So what do you cook on?
So they have stovetops with generators and I mean it's amazing what they're able to do. It's amazing. They have grills, fryers, wood burning ovens, whatever you want, you just request it and you show up the day of and it's there for you.
Wow.
It's impressive. I know. Behind-the-scenes things is actually more impressive than the cooking sometimes. Just the amount of organization it takes to put this whole festival together.
So the porcine cooking will be outdoors?
Yeah. Yeah, it's all outdoors under the tent right in front of the Ritz-Carlton on the beach.
Huh. Right. And so, and I think we need to say here that the FIU students are terrific. They help so much.
Oh, absolutely. They're amazing. They're amazing.
Right. Well, so now let's talk a little bit about Italy and the fact that you grew up there. So, of course, anyone who loves Italian cuisine, I mean, Italy's the place as far as I'm concerned.
For sure.
So how did you become, I know you're passionate about cooking, but how did you want to make it into a professional career for yourself?
I was always hanging around the kitchen growing up. And, you know, my mom is a great cook. My grandmother taught her everything. So I was always hanging around the kitchen, and eating was always such a big part of our family as well. Like, it wasn't, oh, I'm eating out today. It was 6 o'clock, you're home, the whole family. And we had a big family. And then after high school, it was either go to college or I found this course in Piemonte called ICIF, which is an International Culinary Institute for Foreigners. And it was a course more than a culinary school. So it was a 2-month program, and then they place you on a 4-month externship in a Michelin rated restaurant.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so
that's
that was amazing.
Yeah,
it was amazing. So I got to spend 4 months in this amazing restaurant. I ended up getting along with the chef, and even more so the maitre d', who I actually just visited this year. I hadn't seen him in 15 years, and I went back to the restaurant. Where I guess it all started for me, and
he's still there. That's the wonderful thing about some of the restaurants.
He's still there. The container that the salt is kept in is the same one. Like, nothing has changed. It's exactly the same restaurant it was, which is amazing.
Well, that's really wonderful. And you talk about your whole family, excuse me, sitting around the table and eating. And I think we're kind of missing that today. Everybody lives in different cities and different towns. I know where I grew up. All my cousins, we all live within a mile of each other. So
yeah, it was either at my Uncle Mario's house, my house, or my Uncle John's house. All three families were at somebody's house on Sunday.
You
no
know,
exception.
It's
no exception.
Well, that's wonderful, because I remember I was at in Italy and with this woman who was giving a cooking class, and we were all sitting down, and suddenly the doorbell rings, and a young man's there on his bicycle. It was her grandson. And she said, "What are you doing here?" So he said, "I heard you were making my favorite dish. I'm here." And I just think that was so wonderful. It would be great to have that today. Now, okay, so you made this huge leap from Italian cooking to Asian cooking. Now, with Bazzi, what's that all about?
Well, it seems, I guess from the outside, it seems like a huge leap. But as far as, like, I feel like we're just chefs. Like, I didn't only work in Italian restaurants coming up. So it's just a perception that I'm an Italian chef because I have an Italian restaurant. But, you know, coming up through the years, I've worked in French restaurants, Japanese restaurants, fusion restaurants, obviously Italian restaurants as well, you know. I guess my last name is what's jarring about it, but I have a lot of experience in Asian food as well.
But what type of Asian food, Asian can mean a lot of things, so what kind
exactly,
of food is
that's
it?
That's the thing. We're not trying to be traditional at all at Bazzi, so it's my take on those flavors. So it's a lot of those Asian ingredients, be it miso, sake, Shaoxing wine, Szechuan peppers, but it's my take on those flavors. So, and also using a lot of Western techniques.
So, give us an idea of the popular dish there at Bazzi.
So the Peking duck that we do there, it's wildly popular. So.
Oh wow, that sounds good. So do you grow special ducks, or do you buy special ducks that are grown special for Peking cooking?
Yeah, so we get these. It's the Peking breed, and we get them at a farm in Pennsylvania.
So it is a special breed.
Yeah, so we get two deliveries a week, and it's the most beautiful ducks I've ever seen.
And do you blow up the skin? I mean, because in Europe, you see the Chinese restaurants, all the ducks are hanging in the windows because they're drying the skin out.
I love that you know all this. You give me the opportunity to speak on it. So yeah, so we actually have an air compressor. So when the ducks come in, we fill the air so the fat separates from the skin, and then we put them back in the refrigerator and hanging, and they hang for the longer they hang, the better. So we try and hang them for at least 3 days, and then we that dries out the skin, and then we make the maltose and honey mixture that we glaze it with.
Right.
And then it hangs for another 3 days, so that gets in there and dries on.
What is maltose?
It's like a sugar mixture.
It's not maltose. It's a sugar. Okay. O-S-E. It's a sugar.
Have you ever had one of the ducks explode on you?
Leave it to Fred.
I mean, you could hurt yourself right there.
I'm glad to say that hasn't happened yet.
So, Mike, I have to tell you, one time when we made this in England, my husband decided he was going to blow up the skin with a bicycle pump.
It works.
It did work.
When we were testing, I used a basketball pump just to see if it would work. The first duck I ever made, it just takes a lot longer than the electric compressor. But it works, absolutely.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to have to take a short break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Macchialena and Bazzi restaurant owner, Michael Pirollo. He's the owner with Jen Chevsky, right?
Chevsky,
yes. We're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we've been talking with Michael Pirollo. He's the chef owner with Jen Chevsky of the very popular Macchialena and the new Bazzi. They're both on Miami Beach. He's going to be taking part in several events at the South Beach Wine and Food Festival this weekend. In fact, he's going to be in one tonight, and he's spending time with us, so we're delighted he's doing that. If you want more information about that, you can go to Sobe. It's SOBEWFF.com on the internet. Macchialena is on 820 Alton Road, and Bazzi is located in the Marlin Hotel at 1200 Collins Avenue. I think I have to go over that for that Peking duck. What do you think, Joe?
I would love to do that. I was just wondering how someone gets to sleep the night before they have to cook for 2,000 discerning people.
Wait, and he's got an event tomorrow night, a Saturday night, and Sunday. So, and probably something else. Who knows how many? I'm going to ask him in a few minutes.
I wouldn't get a wink of sleep.
Okay, it's dinner in minutes time. So tonight's dinner is a peanut coconut crusted scallop with coconut rice. Now, scallops are really, really easy to make, and they only take about 3 minutes. And the secret to cooking them is to sear them only about a minute and a half on each side. Get that pan really hot and take them off the heat. They'll be translucent in the center, but they'll continue to cook off the heat. With this recipe, I serve it on a bed of spinach. So in the same pan, I add some spinach, and I add a little coconut milk to that. By the way, I've coated the scallops in some chopped peanuts and coconut flakes. That's really major 5 minute recipe. So easy. And then for a side dish, you can buy some microwavable brown rice or white rice and add some coconut milk to it. This is a 10 minute meal. I know, Joe, you could do that.
It would probably take me 20.
Okay, fine. It takes Chef 3 minutes, I'm sure. Anyway, that recipe and a photo.
You're definitely not hired as my sous chef, okay?
Oh, gosh.
Stick to your day job.
I'd slow you down.
Anyway, now, Joe, you can get some sleep. You don't have to worry. Okay, the recipe, complete recipe and a photo. It's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking?
Well, the festival offers a great opportunity to taste literally dozens of wines and write down the ones you like for entertaining at home for the rest of the year. So it's a real opportunity. And this year, there are actually 4 major walk-around tastings, 1 Saturday and 3 Sunday. You can find them at sobefest.com if you want to look them up. And now, if it's your first time at one of these tastings, let me give you a few pointers for having a good time, or at least, as I said, not hurting yourself at the tastings.
Yeah, well, our chefs want to hear about this.
We'll get there in a minute. First, arrive early. Crowds are sparse at the beginning, and toward the end, it can just be an absolute madhouse. And if the weather is hot, is it going to be hot this year, Linda?
No, it's going to be beautiful, actually. Not too hot. Oh,
that's nice. I've been there when it was 90 degrees, and you really got to dress cool.
Well, everyone's calling from Michigan, so let's not talk about hot.
Yeah, it's snowing here.
Okay.
The tasting tents don't have any real air conditioning, and also remember that you'll be walking on sand in the tents, so no high heels. And as you go into the tents, locate the porta-johns. They're on the street side of the big tents, and after a few glasses of wine, you'll really be glad you know where they are.
I'm thankful for that information, Fred.
As you walk, here's another thing you might not expect. As you walk through the entry area, you'll be approached by fetching young women carrying trays of various liquor drinks. Flee from them. This is a wine tasting, and a couple of martinis is not a good palate cleanser for a wine tasting. When you get inside, there will be long tables at which wineries are offering samples of their wares, and there are literally hundreds of wines there, so you can't try them all, obviously. So what you need is a tasting plan. Taste maybe 10 bubblies, then 10 whites, 10 reds, 10 desserts.
We knew that he'd have the bubblies first, didn't we?
Absolutely. That's what you always do in a tasting.
Okay.
That's why if you don't get to the other ones, you're still okay.
I just have to take issue with you on one little item, Fred.
What's that?
High heels work. Now, they may not work for you.
In the sand?
I'm gonna have to back Fred on this one. I've seen a couple of women in high heels, and it's not a pretty sight.
I'm not gonna wear the
opportunity to break the sandals out and
or sneakers.
It's sneakers.
Because it gets dangerous. The guy's an expert. Do not contradict him, please.
No,
but
I
might
know.
Stand there and not be able to move.
I'm just kidding. I've tried to do it. I can tell you firsthand, it doesn't work.
Plus, I really like the image of Fred fleeing from the cocktails.
Well, and the pretty young women. Yeah, I know.
There's no comment there.
When you approach a wine table, you should let them pour you a little dollop and chat with the winemaker for a few seconds, and then step aside. There could be 10 people behind you awaiting their turn, and people who just stand there for 10 minutes become very unpopular. If you are tasting wines at that event, you should sip and spit. Yes, spit. Do not swallow, whatever you do. I know everybody wants to, but if you swallow, your tasting will be over in half an hour, and your liver will be over at the end of the day, and that's where you can really hurt yourself.
And I'd just like to interject here that I've been at this festival. If you're going to spit in the sand, please watch the person who's standing next to you, okay?
Try not to spit across more than one person.
Huh? Exactly.
Well, there are spit buckets at every table. And if you think that's kind of gross and you don't want to be seen doing that, a good tip is you bring a red Solo cup and spit in that very demurely and then empty it into the bucket. It's much nicer that way.
Oh, good.
Finally, please, please take notes. Please don't call me the next day and say you found a wonderful wine, but you can't remember what it was. You don't want to see a grown man cry, do you?
All right. I know, Fred, I always wonder how they have the tasting of those wines, especially when it's very hot. When some of the times it's been hot under the tents, and how do they keep the wine that way?
I don't know if they have coolers or not. I bet they do. They probably have coolers behind their tables that they keep the wines in until it's time to pour them.
Michael, do you know?
I'm pretty sure they have just big ice buckets, and right. They just store everything on ice.
Okay. Well, let's get back to Michael Perillo. You're going to be at several events. I think Saturday night you're going to be at Scarpetta. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm really super excited about this event. So we're doing basically a Scarpetta alumni dinner. So it's Scott Conant, Nina Compton, and myself, and we're all doing one course.
Okay, so it's an alumni dinner because you worked with Scott in New York City at Scarpetta and then here at Scarpetta at the Fontainebleau. Is that correct?
Exactly. And Nina was my sous chef when I came on to Scarpetta in Miami.
Okay.
So then once I left, she replaced me, and now she opened a wonderful restaurant in New Orleans. But she came back to town so we could all do this dinner together.
Are you going to have so much fun there? What are you going to be making?
I'm doing a veal cheek saltimbocca. So it's a take on the classic saltimbocca, but we're doing it with braised veal cheeks instead.
Wow. So okay.
We braised the veal cheeks and then stuffed them with fontina, prosciutto, and sage, and then sear them, and then have a white wine lemon sauce.
I think you're making us all very, very hungry. you have a dish at Macchiolina, and it's called the polenta board. We only have a few seconds left. Tell us that sounds delicious. What is it?
So that's a pretty traditional thing where you would your grandmother would make polenta, and then you'd have a board on a table going the length of the entire dining room table, and she'd just pour polenta all over it with, you know, whether it be meatballs, braised escarole, hanger steaks.
Wow. You're just making us all so hungry.
All over the table.
Mushrooms. So we do a version of that.
No, it's on a board. The polenta's
on a board. Yeah.
And then that food's in the polenta, and everyone can just sort of dig in. Is that right?
Exactly. So we just change it up pretty frequently. We do meatballs, a sausage ragu. We have like a mustard fruit on there. We have truffled mushrooms on there. It's constantly alternating, okay. Changing, well, whatever's in season.
I'd love to hear more about it. Ooh. And Fred wants to get a big spoon out, but we're out of time. It's been a really tasty week. Thank you so much, Michael Perillo, for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. My pleasure. I hope to see you at the tasting tent. And no heels. Remember that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And good luck with all. And there are still tickets left for that, I understand.
No pressure.
So good luck for all of your events at South Beach Festival this weekend. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Joe Cooper and Bonnie Berman, great talking with you.
Thank you. Pleasure as always, Linda.
And next week will be our very popular one-hour restaurant review program. So join us with your favorite restaurant treasures. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
Also known as the Restaurant Roundabout. So thanks for tuning in this hour. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Polly Landis is associate producer. And as always, we have free audio archives for download at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Monday, Bonnie and I have a return visit with tech writer extraordinaire David Pogue with tips for basic life. The best airfare is 52 days before a flight. Why? Get hotels cheaper on cell phones rather than your computer. Snip on sandpaper to sharpen crummy scissors. You get the picture.
Get the last bit of ketchup out of the bottle by swinging it.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Linda Gassenheimer, Fred Tasker. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.